Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for tonight's program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's program featuring John Lancaster, New Yorker contributor and author of the new book, How to Speak Money, What the Money People Say and What It Really Means. John will be in conversation with Michael Lewis, Vanity Fair contributing editor and author of books that include Flash Boys, Moneyball, and Liar's Poker. Let me just give you some more background about each of them. John is the author of the novels The Debt to Pleasure, Mr. Phillips, and Fragrant Harbor, and a memoir, Family Romance. He is a contributing editor at the London Review of Books, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Observer, and The Daily Telegraph, among others. He has won numerous prizes, including the Whitbread and Hawthornden Awards. He was awarded the 2008 E.M. Foster Award by the American Academy of Arts and Letters. As someone who has lived in Hong Kong and in London, I can attest to his remarkable ability to capture the underlying sentiments and tensions in riveting stories of people and of place. His new novel, Capital, proves yet again his remarkable talent. It is no wonder that the Times of the UK wrote, "The Capital is brimming with perception, human empathy, and relish." He will be chatting tonight with Michael Lewis. Michael Lewis is an American nonfiction author and financial journalist. His work has covered decades of endemic global corruption since his debut work, Liar's Poker, currently commemorating its 25th anniversary, which transformed him from a disillusioned bond salesman to the best-selling literary icon he is today. On a personal note, I must take a few seconds to thank Mr. Lewis for helping me with some terrific family bonding. Over the summer, my family and I went on a road trip, during which we listened to his book, Boomerang, on tape. It is amazingly witty, insightful, and terrifying in terms of our ability to be in profound denial, and allowed my family and I to have wonderful dinnertime conversations. Thank you very much. You're about to experience an engaging dialogue between two distinguished authors whose work combines a sophisticated understanding of capital and the foibles of humanity. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome John Lancaster and Michael Lewis.
Thank you very much. I'm Michael Lewis, and I'm in charge here. I'm just going to give you a bit of background on us, because I know John Lancaster from his writing, but we've also met each other on the other side of the Atlantic a couple of times in the last year. I'm on the front of his book. It says, How to Speak Money comes from one of the greatest explainers of the financial crisis and its aftermath. And unlike most blurbs, this is true and genuinely felt. It was actually written in a review of his novel, Capital. I first encountered John's work in the London Review of Books, to which I subscribe, and I was shocked at what came off the page. In fact, I was so the idea that an Englishman was explaining to me how the American financial system had screwed up the world, I found so unlikely that I assumed he was a pseudonym. I didn't believe he existed at first, but then I dug, and we had mutual friends, and I found that this man actually existed, and I began to read all his books. And he's a really gifted writer. There are not many people I feel that way about who are alive anyway. And he's a real talent, and he's more a writer than writer about money. He's a writer who happens to have drifted into this subject and done wonderful things with it. His novel Capital is an example of that. It's the kind of, this isn't exactly a fair description, but it does a bit for London what Bonfire of the Vanities did for New York in 1987. And it actually attempts to describe the way money has overrun London in a way I've never seen anybody do. He wrote a book about the financial crisis called IOU, which was an excellent description of what happened. And his latest book, How to Speak Money, is a lexicon. It's a dictionary of financial terms. Let's talk to him. What's the purpose of the book?
I learned money and stuff from the outside. And it was a byproduct of writing Capital, as it turned out. I wanted to write about London today because it seemed to me that it was a city that had been completely reshaped by money. So I grew up in Hong Kong, and when I first passed through London in the 70s, it seemed like an incredibly grey place. It seemed very provincial compared to Hong Kong, and just everything about it was grey. The buildings were grey, the people were grey, the sky was grey, the food was incredibly grey. In fact, the food had like a whole vocabulary of greyness on the plate. And no one could think that now. It's a city of, you know, immense diversity, energy, colour, vibrancy, with a sort of edge to it. And it seemed to me that it had changed on the order of magnitude of change you get after a kind of revolution or a war. I mean, it's really convulsive change. And I was thinking about the drivers of that, and it seemed to me that one of the main ones was to do with finance. That, you know, London vies with New York for being the capital of global finance. And so I started just learning more about it, realising that I was completely uninstructed in this very, very powerful force in modern life. And for me, the process of learning more about it started with this embarrassingly simple thing of literally not knowing what words meant. You know, I'd be reading things in the paper, I would just literally not know what words meant to an, as I say, embarrassing extent.
Let's back up a little bit. Your father was a banker.
Yeah, of the old-fashioned sort. I mean, he worked for what was then a sleepy colonial institution called the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, which I remember once looking it up. And at that point, when he worked there, it was the 200th biggest bank in Asia. And of course, it's now, you know, global mega bank HSBC, which I think is still the second or third biggest bank in the world.
Yeah,
it was very different kind of. It was like what they call 363 banking, where you take deposits at 3%, you lend money at 6%, and you're on the golf course by 3 p.m. and you don't accidentally blow up the world as a result.
And did you, when you were a kid growing up, did you have any sense of what he did for a living?
No, not really. He didn't talk about it much. He didn't much like talking about money. But he would occasionally, like once or twice, we'd be sort of driving around somewhere and he'd point to, remember once, in fact, it's one of the areas that's been on TV because it's quite near where the protests are, pointing to a thing, I think it was a shoe factory then, and saying that he'd given, when he was the local branch manager, he'd given the initial loan to sort of start the business. So I did have a sense. I think a lot of people feel put off this stuff in advance. They feel kind of pre-baffled, is the term I use in the book, that they kind of, they'll never get their heads around it, they'll never be able to, they're defeated, that's it, it's over. But because, although my dad's kind of banking was very different, but because he worked in it and, you know, knew the people who ran the bank, and I remember him one day coming back from work and saying, I've forgotten who the head of it was at that point, but saying, you know, so-and-so has just bought the British Bank of the Middle East, you know, and so it gave me a sense that they were just people making decisions. So I felt I had sort of permission to understand it.
And when does this happen to you? When do you first start taking an interest in the world of money?
About 2005. I'd written a couple of pieces about companies because I got interested in the idea that there were untold stories in the world of business, that there was either a kind of go-go, boosterish kind of, as it were, business prose, and then there were anti-capitalist critics who thought, you know, every single thing about everything to do with people making money was completely terrible. But there was a sort of gap in the middle. And so I'd done a couple of those and got more interested. And
when you, so let me stop you there, because one of the things, I mean, I don't know if you're unique in England, but close. The combination of literary ability and willingness to try to help the reader understand things. And what I wonder is, when you first started doing this, your ambition was to write novels. Did you feel like you were slumming it?
No, I felt. I mean, I still think of that as my day job. But I think that Tom Wolfe said an interesting thing. He said that most novelists over the age of about 40 think that 90%. Of the interest of what they write is to do with the subject. You know, when you're 25, you think it's all about your amazing sentences.
Yeah.
And then you gradually realise that actually it's about the world, it's about the subject. And that gradually happened to me, and I got more and more interested in the things that felt, you know, under-described and underwritten about.
There is a whole industry dedicated to writing about this stuff. Why did you feel there was a literary opportunity?
Because there's a weird gap. There's a thing in journalism, when you have a scandalous story, you run the scandalous story and they say, oh my God, what are we going to do next week? And the answer comes back, no, it's easy, next week we name the guilty men. And I think, you know, I think the person to blame in the English language literary tradition is Henry James. Because I think Henry, you know, 19th century fiction, it's about the world, it's about subjects that are interesting. You know, Dickens, Balzac, Zola, Trollope, Thackeray, Tolstoy, George Eliot, you know, wrote about the world in front of them. And then Henry James introduces a kind of crack in the novel, because he makes it into capital A art and capital L literature, and only certain things are kind of worthy of serious literary attention. So you get this thing, and I can't remember which one it is. Is it The Ambassadors, where the family fortune derives from a common domestic object in ordinary everyday use? And he never tells you what the flipping thing is. You know. It's 800 pages long, and it's somehow embarrassing. And by the way, there's a consensus in Henry James scholarship that it's something to do with toilets. You know, because it's a kind of flirts into. And you know, Balzac would have written a whole novel about the toilet. You know, about the detailed manufacture and how the factory worked and the industrial relations in the factory and, you know, how the toilet thing got sold and how he cornered the toilet market, etc. But James just won't go there. And I think there's this odd thing in the English language literary tradition that if the subject is inherently interesting, it somehow you get minus literary points.
Yeah.
And I disagree with that.
But it's certainly true.
It is the case. You know.
Yeah.
And it's a you know, it's
well, so who helped you to disagree? Where did this view come from? I mean, it's very you sound like Tom Wolfe. In the essay he wrote at Harper's about where the novel went wrong and kind of explaining why The Bonfire of the Vanities was such a big success.
I disagree with some of Wolfe's emphases and the kind of braggadocio component, but I think there is a sense in which, you know, the literary novel slightly turned its back on the world. And one of the things about the novel is that, you know, if you look at the kind of big forms to do with music, drama, painting, art, all of that, they all take a turn away from the audience in the early 20th century. They take a turn towards the abstract. And the only one of them which takes a turn away and then turns back is the novel, because you cannot have an abstract novel. You can have an abstract piece of music, an abstract painting, abstract sculpture, but you can't have an abstract novel, because the novel just has this built-in relationship with the world and with the audience. And even a very, very negative novel is in some sense slightly in love with the world.
It's inherently populist.
And it has that connection. And I think the reason why music turns away and never comes back, sculpture turns away and never comes back, is because the novel has a sort of... Well, to put it another way, the novel is the only literary form that is younger than the book, rather strangely. You know, everything, poetry, history, drama, even encyclopedia in some traditions, is older than the book. The novel is a young form, and because it's younger than the book, the audience is kind of built in. You know, you can't have a novel without an audience, and the fact that there is this eager public wanting to know about the world around them, wanting to know how life works, that it keeps this kind of thread of, there's a thread of connection with the audience in the novel, I think.
So you had these feelings of rebellion against the literary status quo when you stumble into Money in 2005, and you're willing to go learn about it and go talk to bankers about it. At that point, I sense you had some animosity to what was going on in London. That it wasn't just a detached interest you had in all this.
No, it's true. I mean, I started the novel in 2000 thinking that there was going to be a crash. So it was a kind of... I started the book at the moment describing a kind of bubble moment. And thinking that it would be a dramatic irony in the kind of classic sense, that the dramatic irony is when the audience knows something that the people on stage don't. So if Michael and I both had our flies undone, that would be a dramatic irony of a of an immediate, obviously rather daytime TV kind. And so my idea was that the audience would know. You know, I'm describing the street in the bubble and the bankers being very pleased with themselves and the houses having florists and Pilates instructors and basements being dug out and all that. And the reader would know a crash was coming. So I was really, really interested when this crash did come and turned out to be something much, much bigger and scarier than I'd anticipated. And I was flat wrong, by the way, because although the crash did come, and was it, I thought it was going to be a bubble bursting in the London property market.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, about the only asset category on planet Earth that has gone up uninterruptedly is the London property market.
You know, but it's funny because when I moved to London right out of college in 1983, and I saw the transformation of the place. I was part of it. I mean, I went to school first, but then I worked in the city for Salomon Brothers. And the London I went to was actively hostile to the markets. It was an uncommercial place in a lot of ways. The last place on earth you would think American investment banks would find a natural home. I mean, in the review of your book, I mentioned this. When I got there, I had a little grocery store that I went to. And the grocery store sold these little biscuits that I loved. It was the only thing I could eat. Nothing was edible. Mm. I mean, it was actually incredible. I had a friend from New York who said whenever he walked by an English sandwich shop, he wanted to walk in and strangle the owner. And you just really couldn't eat anything. But you could eat these McVitie's biscuits. Yeah. And I went in to buy some, and one day they weren't there. And I went to the lady who owned the shop, and I said, like, where are the biscuits I always buy? And she said, well, we used to stock them, but we kept running out, so I've stopped. and that was really the kind of sensibility. Yeah. It was like it's too much trouble to make money.
Yeah.
And the idea that this moneyed crowd would roar into the place and transform the city would, I mean, at the time it would have seemed preposterous.
Yeah.
So you watched that like I watched that.
Yeah.
And it bothered you. One way or another, it bothered you.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the impact of the change, and just in terms of, because the novel is set in one street, and I was very struck by the fact that you could see just the texture of life in the street change because of the pressure of finance. And it was just, obviously, you know, the cars got more expensive, there were more work done on the houses, things like that. But one of the things that was interesting was that there would be a house which, you know, people had lived in for 30 or 40 years. And when it sold to the people in finance, because they started buying up houses in the street, when it sold to people, you never knew the owners again because they all flipped the houses every 18 months. And there was something quite striking about that, that the kind of a place that had a particular set of human textures and human interactions, and suddenly it was like one of them dropped out and then the house would be flipped and flipped and you never knew them again. And then the other thing that was also, it was like a work of feminist science fiction because the men get up at 6, they're gone before dawn, they're back God knows when at night. So you never saw an adult man in the daytime, and yet they were continuing to reproduce. Because, you know, the wives would come out and load the children into these SUVs and then drive them off somewhere. And that was one of the germs of the book, the sense of the kind of, just the texture of life in a perfectly ordinary street being kind of rearranged by these large impersonal forces to do with the capital.
Did you blame us for it? Did you think this is an Americanization of English life?
No, because I grew up in Hong Kong. So right. I see it as a kind of reverse takeover, because Hong Kong at that point was the most red in tooth and claw hyper-capitalist society in the world. So I see it as really, you know, Hong Kong having taken over the rest of the planet.
That's funny, because from my point of view, it looked like Americans overrunning London. And an American way of life. All of a sudden, these kids at Oxford and Cambridge want to work for American investment banks. They start to say things that they just would never say in polite company in England in order to ingratiate themselves with investment bankers and get jobs at Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley.
Oh, it's definitely changed that kind of culture of, you wrote about this the other day in terms of, you know, those sort of hyper-educated elite kids who at the same time don't quite know what to do with their lives will do the thing they perceive as having most prestige and money, and it's has that in that sort of Oxbridge-y way, the people who would once have dreamed about, I don't know, being prime minister or, you know, poet laureate or whatever, they now want to go and work for those incredibly well-paying financial institutions. But it's not just American, because a metaphor that's sometimes used in England is what they call Wimbledonization, in that the venue is local but the talent is international. and you can see, you know, there are lots and lots of European bankers, and it's actually hilarious how far off you can spot them, because you only see the men at weekends. And there's this very interesting project that people are with their children, but they're trying to do as many of the things that they would be doing if their children weren't there as possible. So they're sort of drinking, they're always on one phone, quite often on two. And, you know, they're clearly at work while the children kind of run around and doing their other stuff. And the European bankers, it's really interesting, you can spot them at about 400 yards off, because there's this particular thing they do with their sweaters. They have these sweaters and they wear them over their shoulders, but with the kind of arms draped down. And that is a European bank, and they're always kind of these interesting kind of pastel cashmere colours. And you can spot them, you know. Yeah, you can spot them at a range. A sniper would be able to take them out.
All right, so you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is John Lanchester, a New Yorker contributor and author, and we're discussing how the world of finance really works. I'm Michael Lewis. You can also find the video of Commonwealth Club programs on the club's YouTube channel. So let's get to the book. The book is a dictionary. It reminded me of Ambrose Bierce's Devil's Dictionary. Do you know the book?
I do. I love that book.
I love that book, too. I mean, and you've done an amazing job of taking, essentially, I mean, there's an essay on either end of the dictionary, but the dictionary itself is very, very readable. The joy of it is that even if you know what a bailout is or what a CDO is, that the descriptions that you provide get you thinking about them in a new way. I'm curious about how you decided what to include in this thing.
Well, I started with, I would say this because I'm a writer, but for me, the first obstacle and the main obstacle to following the subject was just at the level of vocabulary. It's this embarrassingly simple thing of just not knowing what the words mean, and that was the first hurdle I had to overcome.
So you just kept a list of things you didn't know.
Yeah, I tracked it down. You know, when I was starting to read the stories, I would just, whenever there was a word I didn't know the meaning, I would pursue it until I felt I did know the meaning.
Can I stop you?
Sure.
When you found you didn't know something, and presumably you developed a network of financial people you could call and ask questions of, you seem to know some bankers. And
I do know a few,
Did you find that when you put your questions to people who were supposed to know, they often couldn't explain?
Yeah, very often. Yeah. Yeah. and one of the things that, I was really mortified about the fact that it struck me, fiscal and monetary. You know, I went to Oxford, I got a first-class degree, I worked for 10 years on a political and literary magazine, and I was almost 50 years old before I knew what fiscal and monetary meant, which is really embarrassing. And I happened to mention this at an event I was doing, and the guy I was talking to used to work for Reuters. And he said, oh, it's funny you should mention that. We used to ask that in interviews and job interviews, and 80% of the professional financial journalists applying to work in Reuters couldn't define fiscal and monetary.
There's a horrible fear of seeming ignorant in the financial community. What it does is it creates an opportunity for all kinds of BS to slip in, because nobody wants to say, I don't know.
Nobody wants to be the kid who says, excuse me, that emperor dude has no clothes.
So this starts with you reading the Financial Times and trying to figure out what these words mean.
Yeah.
Where does it end? Do you feel like you know? Do you feel like you're now expert in the financial world?
Absolutely not. No. And the entertaining thing is that whenever there's a new scandal or disaster, it's usually something you'd never heard of. It's like the J.P. Morgan thing about, you know, the famous London Whale, yeah, which was a tempest in a teacup until it turned out to be 8.2 million billion bucks.
Yeah.
And that was something about forward settling ETF derivatives.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows what they are?
I mean, so whenever there's something blows up, it's always something you've never heard of.
So I want to read a little. I want to read a little passage. May I? Just This is in his when he's explaining who Benjamin Graham is. One of the things I've been doing since I began taking an interest in the world of money is ask people involved in that world what they do with their own money. My question, in essence, is whether they do the things we civilians are advised to do in respect of pensions and equity investments and the like. I reckon I have asked 40 or so finance professionals this, and I haven't yet met a single one who follows the advice given to civilians. Their reason for not doing so are always twofold and always the same. They say, A, the fees charged are too high, and B, you can't really tell what's going on inside these companies. Yeah. Do you, as you wandered the world of investment professionals, has it alarmed you what you found? Let me put the question another way. So you've got this wonderful dictionary explaining terms to lay people that they probably don't understand, and probably explaining it to professionals in ways they don't understand. Do you feel that the obfuscation that goes on in the financial world is deliberate, or do you feel it's just an accident of some sort?
Well, funny enough, that was the question I was going to ask you. It's a funny, whenever you have a book out, I'm sure you notice this, there's always one question that keeps coming up, and it's always one you're not quite expecting. With my first novel is about a psychopathic snob, obsessive foodie, and serial murderer who kills, I can't remember, it's 9 or 10 people. And the question I was most often asked when it came out was, is it autobiographical? A decade and a half later, I still haven't worked out the correct reply to that. And the one with this book, is the way the Brits put it, is, do they do it on purpose? You know, that's what I think about that is that actually it doesn't matter, because the effect is obfuscatory and the effect is to bamboozle people. And if someone's talking to you about, you know, super synthetic CDS is based on synthetic CDOs based on RMBS. It doesn't matter if that person is deliberately trying to bamboozle you or just, you know, using arcane vocabulary. It's the effect that matters, and the effect is systematically excluding and exclusive. But so what's your view, as it were, do they do it on purpose?
Kind of, yes.
Yeah.
But it's more complicated than that, because I think that often when people dream up complicated things, the people who do the dreaming up, they don't want you to understand. The people that, right. It's better if you don't. It's better for them if you don't. There's a kind of arbitrage opportunity in your ignorance. But what happens very quickly is that the people who dream them up explain them to the salespeople who don't completely understand them, and right. They start repeating things. And so by the person who's actually deceiving you often doesn't understand what he's saying. Mm. So it becomes less and less deliberate as you get further and further away from the origin, from the source of creation. Mm. But you know, all professions have their argo. They all have their shorthand, and some of it's useful. So it's not all bad. The problem in the financial system is that so much of it is bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so much of it. I mean, if you think about, if you try to explain, if someone had just explained what a collateralized debt obligation was, that was filled with the worst pieces of subprime mortgage bonds, if someone had said, those are the worst loans ever made in the history of man, all piled up in one place, and they've been given AAA ratings. I mean, I think that people would have, you know, stopped and thought about it a little more.
Yeah.
But they didn't put it that way. And the financial sector doesn't put it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I can go on about this, and this is your conversation, not mine.
No, but
I would say that at the bottom of it all, I do feel sometimes is that the financial sector often creates for itself jobs that don't need to be done. There is a useful purpose it serves. It's a pretty simple, useful purpose. It's supposed to be bringing borrowers together with lenders, capital together with people who need the capital. I guess if you go one layer below that, it's evaluating risk and exposing risk, and so people can evaluate it properly. Mm. But in addition to that legitimate function, it does all the stuff it shouldn't be doing. It pretends to an expertise that not only does it not have, but that doesn't exist. So, you know, predicting the prices of individual stocks or where gold is going to go or all the different things, a lot of the advice that's given is basically nonsense. And so, I mean, it's just unknowable. I mean, they're telling you, they're kind of suggesting they know things that are unknowable. And the language is designed to prevent you from getting to that essential truth. It's designed to make you feel kind of uncomfortable in the presence of any conversation about money. So you kind of give yourself over to the person who's supposedly the expert and never find out that he actually doesn't have an expertise. So I say that. It sounds very critical, I know, but I think it's just the way it is. I don't mean it to be mean. I think it's just kind of the way it is, and I think anybody who's sane with their money doesn't listen to, they shouldn't take much in the way of advice, especially advice they're paying for in a weird way. The more you pay for it, the more dangerous it is. So, yeah, I'm partial cynic about the nature, about the language, but I think also a lot of the people in the financial sector don't know this about themselves. They think they know things they don't know.
I heard a really interesting thing. Someone came up at a talk I gave in New York, and he said, you know, in addition to the things you talk about obfuscation, he was saying to me, you know, this thing about obfuscation and intent and whether they're doing it or not on purpose. But he also made a very interesting point. He said that there's also a dissociating effect, that it helps you switch off from what it is you're actually talking about. And this guy works in leverage buyout. And I was very struck by this because I hadn't thought about the dissociating ability for it for the people on the other side. And they were looking at some numbers for a business and going through, and there was churn in the business. There was new numbers coming in periodically. And he suddenly sort of stepped back and thought for a minute and realized that what they were looking at was a residential care home. And the churn was people dying. And he said that, you know, that, and I must admit, I'd never thought about that, that the language also gives a layer of sort of insulation for people making fairly brutal choices.
When you stumbled into this subject, you probably didn't think you'd be writing about it a decade later. And you probably, if I'd asked you 30 years ago when you began your life as a novelist, if you'd be writing primers on how to understand the finance, you look at me like I was off my rocker. Do you feel like this is something that is now a part of your life? I mean, are you looking forward to moving on from finance, or is this, do you feel like this is something that is like a gift that keeps on giving to you?
The stories continue to be interesting, and at the same time, I wouldn't, you know, after I wrote IOU, there's a saying they have in British journalism, especially in the tabloid papers. They say, no is just an emotional way of saying yes. And when I wrote IOU, I said, right, that's it, never again, never another word about finance, that's it, I'm finished, Elvis hasn't just left the building, he's dead on the toilet, that's it, it's over. And greatly to my surprise, I ended up, because I kept being asked to explain, that was the common thread, this thing about explanation.
Does it surprise you? This opportunity that sort of existed for you, that people are hungry for these things you're writing?
I think it's linked to the fact that people feel that nothing's changed since 2008.
Yeah.
I think for an awful lot of people, it's still 2008, and they feel like flies trapped in amber. You know, that as nothing's changed, their own circumstances haven't changed, the system hasn't changed, as the bad guys got away with it, it's still there. So It doesn't surprise me because of that. I think in every other way, yeah, I can't quite believe it in many respects. But I also think that I feel at a kind of point. I'm sure you notice people that lots of people very preoccupied by money are quite boring.
Yeah,
and I'm just starting to feel a thing that. Realizing, well, it's actually slightly inimical beyond a certain point. It's inimical to the project of writing fiction because money in economics always seeks to be the explanation. And there's a thing that's interesting about the phenomenon behind the thing, the reason behind the thing, you know, behind the veil. But at the same time, if the reason for everything is always economic and money, you can't really imagine a novel written on that.
No, the mind comes to rest well short of a novel.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And it's actually... It's a kind of antithetical project. It's the opposite of a novel, eventually. And I suddenly realized when I was writing this book, I was thinking, actually, I probably do have to leave it here because if I keep on with this, I won't be able to see the sort of human content in things as opposed to just the economic transaction.
You were a man of the left in England, which puts you, which makes you on our political spectrum a pinko.
I don't self-identify
as a pinko.
No, as a man of the left.
No, you don't.
You're the guy famous for wearing pink shirts.
Yeah,
you can't start.
I was going to say something like that, you're associated with vaguely left-wing journals. You move in left-wing literary circles, that kind of thing. Do your friends think it's strange you've gone on this jag? And do they? I'm curious, especially if they think you're too sympathetic to the world of money. Because you have to be somewhat sympathetic to do the job you've done explaining. You can't be just hostile. And you're not, that's what's interesting. You're not hostile. You're not really hostile.
I think you can't write about it unless you're ambivalent about it.
Yeah.
I think you're ambivalent about it too. And I think that's part of the interest is to do with that. I mean, Kazuo Ishiguro, who I know you've met, said a very interesting thing about, I mean, he loves reading about this stuff. And he gave me this very interesting reason. He says that they're like artists or like criminals in that they're just interested in getting the thing done. What's the thing that makes money? Ignore the rules, ignore everything, just how do you get to the object?
Right.
And there's a kind of amorality involved in that. And actually in lots of artistic endeavours, there is a kind of amorality and ruthlessness too. So I do think part of me definitely resonates to that. Now, yeah, people do get, there is a sort of default lefty thing, I think, in Europe in general about, you know, anything to do with any kind of functioning of markets. It's a bit like your McVitie's biscuits lady. Yeah. You know, it's obviously wrong and deranged and sort of morally, any enterprise that has any kind of economic component is morally bankrupt.
Yeah.
And I think I both disagree, and I actually think it's kind of stupid, and it misses some of the interest of it.
Yeah. So I'm going to take, can we do some questions from
the
audience?
Sure.
There's several for me, which I'm going to ignore. But for you, you grew up in Hong Kong. Money is also a key driver of what's happening there now. In addition to Beijing's brutish behavior, can Hong Kong continue to prosper within the Chinese system?
That's a big one. I hope so. I mean, I think that I see what's going on at the moment as being more than an economic thing, and maybe almost more than a political thing. It's to do with identity. That I think that both the Brits and the Chinese, when Chinese Communist Party, when the handover was arranged, I think they underestimated the extent to which Hong Kongers feel Hong Kongers. They feel Hong Kongese as distinct from Chinese or Guangdongese. They feel Hong Kongese as a distinct identity. And it's. I think the notion was, handover was in 1997, the elections that they're arguing about are in 2017. I think that the notion was that the great and the good had thought that Hong Kong will be gradually sort of assimilating with China by now, and that a lot of the things will, you know, be growing together. And in fact, what's happened is that sense of Hong Kong identity as a distinct, separate thing has grown stronger, especially for young people. The more they see of the mainland, the more they realise that, no, actually, they're different from it. So I do think it's a thing about identity, a deep-rooted way that's taking a kind of political manifestation. So I very much hope that they figure out a way. Hong Kong is immensely useful to mainland China as an entrepot, and also as a place where a lot of the, because there's no company law in China.
Right.
You know, there's no law in terms of,
no, if they didn't have it, they'd have to create it.
Yeah, that's right. And so lots of people incorporate in Hong Kong in order to do business.
Right.
So I think if you, the broad guiding principle for anything to do with China is that the Chinese Communist Party tends to get what it wants. And I think what it wants is for Hong Kong to continue to be an entrepot and for it to be, you know, relatively stable. So I imagine that some kind of deal will be struck to do with maybe, you know, the current chief executive being encouraged to take some form of early retirement. I noticed a scandal surfaced about him in the Australian papers, and if I were him, I'd be asking a whole bunch of questions about where that scandal came from, because it makes it much easier for him to be discreetly eased towards the exit.
Another member of the audience says that London epitomizes the wealth gap today. Russian and Chinese oligarchs buying homes, buying 20 million, 20 million scratched out for some reason, because they're probably too small. Buying homes and driving up prices. Can this go on in the same way? I don't know.
It is. I'm not sure it is. It is a very, very striking thing, though, the extension. I mean, the rich middle parts of town are just empty. Around Mayfair and Knightsbridge. And
Nobody's living there.
Nobody lives there.
They're just investment properties.
Yeah, and there was a very striking thing in Kensington and Chelsea, which is the richest constituency, the richest electoral constituency in the entire European Union. And in the 2011 census, we have a census every 10 years, same as you guys do, it was the only area in the entire British Isles where the population had fallen. And that's a sinister and weird thing. If the richest place, which would be a magnet for the population, is going down because things are empty, so you know it doesn't feel sustainable. But it may be that we're having an odd thing that London has effectively decoupled from the rest of the UK, maybe even from the rest of Europe, and there's a sort of international capital megacity, like with New York, and maybe the Asian version is, say, Singapore. And so, in a weird way, they actually aren't in their physical location anymore. They're in this sort of other location that's just purely to do with money. So the local version, you know, clearly not sustainable, but maybe if it's sort of decoupled, maybe that's a bit different.
Do you know, is there any kind of friction between the locals and the oligarchs who roll in and buy up big chunks of London? And is there any tension at all?
No, not particularly, because, you know, and a funny thing, because of the hollowing out that occurs, you know, in those bits of the very rich bits of London, there are only rich and poor,
right.
And the poor are there to service the rich.
Yeah.
There's no one else. There's, you know, oligarchs and doormen, and that's it.
Right.
I mean, the one thing that Londoners do like is you get this thing during the hot months of the year in the Arabian Peninsula, that they the younger princes and princelings bring their supercars to London. So you see this astonishing parade of, you know, Maseratis, Bugattis, this, that, and the other. I mean, you know, cars worth $500,000 just driving up, and because of London traffic, it's at least as bad as it. They're doing 2 miles an hour, just moving up and down Knightsbridge very, very slowly. Is it? And it really does, you know, it's like something out of Tom Wolfe or Fellini or some bizarre, or Monty Python. You know, this thing of these, and, you know, I mean, the locals all think that's hilarious.
If I put you in charge, if I make you God of Great Britain, what do you change? Is inequality, does this growing sense of inequality, I don't know what the numbers look like. I assume you're experiencing a similar sort of thing that we're experiencing here.
Yeah.
Growing gap between rich and poor, a sense that it's not just the 1%, but the 0.1%
yeah.
who taking ever more of the gains, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is it creating anything that looks like class warfare to you?
I think it creates gigantic resentment, yeah, but a lot of it is directed at London from outside London.
So we don't do class warfare very well here, but you do it very well. You would think that if there were going to be a revolution, it would start over there.
I think scroll it forward a bit, and I think there will be tensions in that direction. I think it was a big thing in the Scottish independence referendum.
Yep.
I was out there before, and there was a lot of, kind of, there's a sort of joke version in which the Scots hate the English, which is like lots of jokes, slightly true. But that's a kind of permanent sort of jokey, rancorous thing. The thing that has really taken on extra force there is a very specifically anti-London thing. That thing about being run. Because the thing about London is it's 15% of the population. So I looked at the numbers in an American context, and it is San Francisco plus Los Angeles plus New York plus Chicago plus Miami, plus Washington, you know, and you go, I think you have to add the top 20 American cities together
right.
before you get the scale of London as a percentage of the population. And then it's also the media centre, it's also the artistic centre, it's where all the rich people are, it's by far the most ethnically diverse place, it's where people go if they want to, you know, write apps or screenplays or music or so on, and it's the political capital. So if that then is sort of separating out from the rest, and that's where the kind of 1% and the 0.1% are living, there is a real potential for very serious splits, really.
So what do you do to fix things?
Well, there's a few things that you could do to do with that in relation to making it less of a magnet for rootless international capital. We have this, our system doesn't just bend over backwards to accommodate international capital, actually limbo dances. And we have a thing that if you're a very rich person, you can live in London completely free of tax on your capital assets. I mean, that's why the oligarchs are there. They're not there because they love our weather. You know, it's because they literally pay zero tax on capital. They only pay tax on income, so they take great care. And it's that's never been explained why that law was brought in. It was, I think, initially around the time of attracting shipping magnates in the 70s, then Arab oil money in the later 70s, and then, you know, basically, if you're a James Bond villain who's got away with it, you come and live in London. And that would be, that's an easy fix. You know, we change the tax to the way you guys have it.
Do you think that the British should introduce a more progressive tax structure?
I think the tax structure is okay. You know, the top 1% pay about of income tax. Earners pay about 30% of tax. That's not obviously unfair. If you'd said that to Marx, if you'd offered him that deal, because progressive taxation is one of the 10 things in the Communist Manifesto, he'd have said that was fine. I think the problem is the people who don't pay tax at all is more of an issue. And there's a, you know, Thomas Piketty, he has a student who's done this thing, who's studied the assets and liabilities of planet Earth. And, you know, in principle, assets and liabilities always match. That's just the way accounting works. But if you look at the global balance sheet, the liabilities exceed the assets. Earth is somehow in debt to itself.
Yeah.
Which is...
No, you mentioned this. I don't know where it is in here, but the numbers are wonderful.
Yeah.
What are they? Remind me what they are.
I don't remember actually quoting that in the book. I must have been in a trance-like state when I wrote it. That's the crystal meth again. And you know, since the Earth can't be in debt to itself, what's happened is that the missing assets are hidden offshore. That, you know, nobody knows where they are because they're in trusts, they're in tax havens, they're in offshore and off balance sheet structures. And that seems to me as something that really does need fixing in a coordinated international way. And that's barely even the 0.1%. It's like the 0.01 or the 0.001. But I used to think, oh, that's a marginal issue, the rich are always going to cheat. But actually now I think that's a really big missing part of the kind of democratic picture, that thing of just everybody paying their fair share of tax, but really meaning everybody.
Between restructuring and rights issues, you have rich lists.
Oh, yeah.
Which gets to this.
Yeah.
And your point, very well taken, that they're all nonsense.
Yeah.
That you actually do, that we don't have a very good idea at all of what rich people are worth.
No, and it's actually very hard to measure wealth if you actually directly look after it. I was quite struck by this economist method, though, of, you know, looking at the assets and liabilities and just seeing what's missing.
Yeah. All right, another question from the audience. Every profession appears to have good and bad members. Do you think the compensation practices of Wall Street results in a disproportionate number of bad, dishonest members of the profession?
The evidence would suggest that. I mean, I think you know, there's a problem with the incentives. Sounds a boring way of putting it, but I do think that if you have very, very smart people incentivized to sort of get around the rules any way they can, you're gonna have a problem with it. But there's also a thing about the culture. We had this thing in the recent epidemic of bank fines. There was one that was very striking. One of our big banks, Barclays, was fined $260. I should have now forgotten what. Yeah, that's right. £250 million. So. $260 billion, so nearly $500 million for rigging LIBOR.
LIBOR.
And there was
you actually need a pronunciation.
Yeah, exactly. LIBOR, LIBOR. And which is the global interbank rate, which is, I mean, it's an amazing thing that they were rigging it because it's the most important number in the whole global financial system. But anyway, rigging it they were. And then in the kind of small print of all the stuff about fines, there's a thing came out about a guy being fined for rigging the gold spot market.
Yeah.
There's no gold market in London, exchange market. They agree a price. And when you have that thing, when people agree a price over the phone, it's very, very prone to being manipulated because you buy a bunch of the stuff, then you agree a price slightly above what you paid, and kaboom, you know, you're quit in. And this guy was fined £23 million for rigging it. But the thing that really stood out about that to me was the day on which he tried to rig the gold market was the day after his employer was fined $500 million for rigging a market. So your employer is fined $500 million for rigging a market you go into work the next day and you try and rig a market. And what that suggests to me and to the questioner is that that's a cultural problem that is so deeply entrenched. You know, I know everyone talks about leadership, we can fix it, blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure you can fix that if it's that hardwired, that baked in.
So what do you do?
Well, I suspect there's another convulsion coming, you know, because of their equity is paper thin. And, you know, as I was in Washington the other day when the IMF thing was going on, and I think there is, you know, people are worried that things haven't been fixed. And I suspect, you know, when this plays out...
This is an interesting point. Nobody actually thinks the financial sector has been fixed.
No, nobody.
Now, there may be people who think it never needed to be fixed in the first place, and that what happened had nothing to do with the financial sector. There are people who make that argument.
Yeah.
Do you buy that argument?
No.
No, neither do I. No. So we're not going to argue about that. No. But nobody who thinks that the structure of the financial sector had something to do with this cataclysm that we're all still living through has been repaired.
Yeah.
The question is, what comes next? I mean,
I imagine what we'll end up with. I think and I hope the end state is banks effectively being regulated like utilities.
Yeah.
And bankers immediately burst into tears and start telling stories about how, you know, nobody will invest them and blah, blah, blah. But in fact, you know, people invest in utilities companies all the time. Yeah. They're quite good investments.
The job should be boring like your father's job was.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the return on equity of these banks is terrible for the most part, mainly because they pay themselves so much. You know, the return on equity isn't great compared with pretty much anything. Right. So the banks are more like utilities. And if you want to, you know, I think in some senses, hedge funds, though they don't have a great name, they're a kind of model of how it's supposed to be, because it's people risking their money and their investors' money. And in a good year, they fill their swimming pools full of Dom Perignon and they crash their Ferrari into it. And in a bad year, they go broke. And everyone says, oh, bye-bye, don't let the doorknob hit you in the butt on the way out. Yeah. And it doesn't, you know, we don't have to bail them out. It's a kind of feral capitalism in the way it's supposed to work.
Right.
And the vast majority of hedge funds that have ever existed have either closed or gone broke, you know, because their strategies stop working, they just return the money to their investors. So, and I think we'll end up with a split between banks regulated like utilities and all the go-go, exciting, sexy stuff where they bet against each other. One guy wins, one guy loses. And they, you know, cavort around with their exotic financial instruments in a kind of separate sector of the economy, not so unlike the sector that we have now.
And you think we get from where we are now to there with some sort of other convulsion?
I suspect so. Yeah, I don't think we're going to common sense our way towards that goal. Mainly because, you know, they're the most powerful and influential and richest lobby in the world, and, you know, they tend to get what they want.
I want to ask another question from the audience. There's one that's slightly critical of us both. Let me find it. Here it is. Michael and John, it's easy to be a skeptic about any industry. What do you propose be the alternative? Thanks, a Wall Street analyst.
Well, alternative to what? I mean, I think that I suspect that, you know, you were talking about the, you know, you can understand borrowers, you can understand lenders. I think and that's what banks are supposed to do, match the two up and help allocate capital. I think that that function of the banking system will gradually be disinvented. And I think it's interesting in countries that haven't had banking. You see this in sub-Saharan Africa, that you've kind of skipped a generation. What you have is direct people transferring money direct to each other through things like mobile phone apps. You know, you have debtors and creditors doing the transactions directly without a financial intermediary. And I think that the whole sector is ripe for disruption. So I think we'll move towards a lot of the functions of banks simply disappearing, being invented away. One of the ironies about it, though, is that there's the more regulation you have around it, that ends up, you know, one of the many ironies about the aftermath of the credit crunch is that a lot of the things that were wrong are worse. The too big to fail problem is worse because the banks are bigger.
Do people talk about it in England the same way they do here? I mean, are the problems, when people bemoan the state of the financial sector, are they talking about the same things, too big to fail, for example?
Yeah.
Lots of unnecessary activity.
Yeah, and
rigging of systems.
No, all of that, and our too big to fail is even, you know, our problem is even worse than yours, because your big bank balance sheets are about the size of your GDP, whereas
we actually could afford to have some of our banks fail.
No, we can't. Because our four biggest banks are five times the size of our economy.
How did that happen? Well, I mean, this is amazing. It's not as bad as Iceland was. No. But it's along the road.
It's along the path. Well, they would say they were always major international institutions as a kind of legacy of empire and all that.
Right.
And I think it's also partly, though, that if you want to grow your finance sector really, really quickly, you just deregulate. You just rip up the rules and the capital comes pouring in, because the capital is always looking for somewhere where there are fewer rules and you can do more of the stuff you want to do. And it's no accident that quite a few of the things that blew up in 2008, like the AIG unit, which is, there's all these legal arguments going on about at the moment, but that AIG unit was based in London, and the London Whale JP Morgan thing, again based in London. I think it's partly because, you know, the regulation's lighter, and if you just tear up the rules and the capital comes pouring in.
Why is there more political pressure than brought to bear on the banks?
I don't know. I think that they're scared of the banks.
Well, is this true? So this, a member of the audience just said they own the politicians, which is the sort of thing people scream for the audience. It's putting it too strongly. Mm. It's more complicated than that. But there is such a thing as a bias-centered strategy.
Yeah.
And you can cause it. You can. It's easy to prevent things from happening.
Yeah.
It's not true. It's not true.
No.
It's same in England. It's harder to see the connections.
Money hasn't taken over politics in quite the same way.
Right.
It's not quite as overt. But, you know, there's also the, you know, the £800 gorilla problem, because, you know, our banks are so huge, that thing about being five times the size of the GDP, and they do find it very easy when they don't own the politicians, which they sometimes do. They find it very, very easy to bully and blackmail them. And certainly anytime anyone talks about anything about credit or changing the rules, they basically put this puppy on their lap called the UK economy, and they hold a revolver in their hand and start stroking the puppy and saying, what were you saying about tightening credit rules? And they said, this is such a nice puppy. It would be terrible if something happened to it. You know, yeah. And they, you know, they back off.
it's a wonder that people aren't angrier.
It is strange.
Here I understand it, because we don't get angry about these sort of things in the same way. But there, people get angry. I can remember in 2008, I had friends who worked on Wall Street and worked in New York and who had business reasons to go to London. They were afraid to go to London because they were beating up bankers in the streets.
Yeah.
And there was a brief moment where I felt like something.
There wasn't. Yeah.
It would have felt. A little,
and often misdirected, though. You know, people.
Yeah, of course.
They read something about some, you know, as it was Barclays rigging libel,
right.
And get angry at the cashier across the counter who's, you know, barely earning minimum wage.
Right.
You know. So it's strange, the thing about anger. I mean, I saw it a lot in Ireland. I'm half Irish. I go there a lot, and you know, Ireland's had a terrible experience with a boom that got out of hand that you wrote about in Boomerang. You know, that was sort of real economic growth until about 2000, and then 8 years of bubble afterwards, and then imploded. And you have an odd thing about people being glazingly, furiously angry and resigned at the same time. Well, I've never seen anything quite like it, but incredibly, incandescently furious, completely philosophically resigned people.
They also felt guilty. They also felt that they felt complicit in it all.
I think they realized that it had got out of hand.
And the Irish, you have to admit, the Irish have just a real talent for suffering. That when presented with the opportunity to suffer, they rarely turn away from it.
It's true. And my mother's family come from Mayo, which is the county with the largest number of penitential pilgrimage sites as well, which they say explains everything about the performance of their sports team.
Assuming that, here's another question from the audience. Assuming that the foundation of an economy is the trust that the playing field is fair, do you feel that there's been a betrayal of that trust that endangers our economy?
I think there is an issue about trust, to put it mildly. And I think that, you know, I think the big, dark, difficult thing about inequality, Yeah, I mean, you know, in some versions of political thought, there is, as it were, a fair version of inequality, which is just, you know, as it were, the more talented people do better. There's, as it were, a right-wing philosophy of inequality and fairness. But I think the problem with where we are now is that there is a proven, in the sense that it's clearly in the evidence, correlation between inequality and heritability. That the more unequal a society, the more life chances are inherited. So we're travelling towards this thing with, you know, a baby is born, is whacked on the backside, and with its first lung full of air, draws in its future income prospects, its future education level, and even its life expectancy.
Yeah.
You know, rich and poor, from that one moment, everything is set in course. And I think that's a really, really dark prospect. And I think we are actually travelling down a route towards a society that's more and more like that, because that's what the numbers suggest. And I think that's a fundamental breach of trust in the way that, you know, the social contract is supposed to work.
So what's the political response to that? Where do you see it?
I don't really.
Odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you think in a democracy there'd be an upheaval?
But I think it's a little bit like, you know, the famous thing Churchill, who was half American, said about America. Churchill said that, you know, you can always trust America to do the right thing, but only after they've tried everything else first.
Right.
And I think something about a bit similar is true of democracies. I think that the fact that a lot of people are very preoccupied by this will eventually translate into politicians actually addressing it. It's just it hasn't quite happened yet. I think they're frightened of the word inequality.
Apropos of nothing, I do want to read your little passage on the Laffer curve just to give people a flavor of the book. So the Laffer curve, the most influential, this is John Lanchester's definition of the Laffer curve, the most influential ever idea to have first arrived in the world on a cocktail napkin. Author Laffer is an American economist who explained this idea to two officials in the Nixon and Ford administration in 1974. The idea was, in essence, the government could raise more money in tax by cutting tax rates. Laffer drew a curve that plotted tax rates against the income raised from tax. He made the point that at 0%, the government raises no money, but at 100% tax, again, the government raises no money because nobody will do any work if the government confiscates all the proceeds. So the tax rate that raises the most money isn't automatically right at the top end of the scale. Governments will often raise tax revenue by cutting rates of tax. As you can probably imagine, this idea is very, very popular with rich people. Reagan's administration was the first to put this theory into practice. The two officials to whom Laffer pitched the idea were Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. So it is literally the case that the same people who cooked up the second Iraq War also brought us tax cuts for the rich. To quote the napkin itself, the consequences are obvious.
Did you actually look up the napkin online? You can actually see the photo of the napkin. It's really.
Did you have fun writing this book?
I did and I didn't. I had fun thinking about it, and I had fun with some of the terms, but I did go through that thing of suddenly, that I was describing, of thinking that actually there's a kind of tipping point for your worldview narrowing with this stuff. You know, that thing about the explanation.
Mine is already so far narrowed that I will never come back. But I understand what you mean.
It doesn't show in your work. I mean, and you've continued to be interested in the world, and sometimes people, that sort of flips over. The world is only interesting insofar as it gives you the numbers.
Yeah.
That's the thing you notice with a lot of people who've, you know, that Shakespeare line, my nature is subdued to what it works in like the dyer's hand. You know, that does happen with money.
Do you have an explanation to yourself that you tell yourself about why you're good at explaining this stuff?
I know, but I like new things. You know, I like being interested in new things, and I like the process of finding out about stuff, and... You know, the explanation is to me first. I'm the first person to whom it's being explained, and I like that sensation of finding stuff out and you know, working through how it works. But I don't think about it more than that. But I noticed that I have a kind of
a
neophiliac.
No, it's a very funny thing. You have the gift, and it's a very unusual gift. And I think at bottom it's one. You're not afraid of seeming ignorant. Hmm. You're not afraid of your own ignorance. Hmm. So that's maybe related to liking new things. But it's a fearlessness that I think is very admirable. So I want to, we're at the end of our program. And is there anything else you want to say?
No.
Before I close this up here?
Absolutely.
You sure? Did we miss anything you really wanted to get to?
There's only one point in the book that really interests me that we haven't covered, which is that a thing that comes out in the data about, because there's also an optimistic thing about the state of the world, about we having halved infant mortality, halved the number of people living in absolute poverty, you know, within 20 years, which is an astonishing material achievement. And so we're having this very odd thing, which I think has never happened in the history of the world, that inequality between countries is narrowing. Countries are getting closer together at the same time as inequality inside countries is sharply increasing. And I think that's, you can't put that on a slogan, you can't, you know, on a T-shirt, you can't march behind that banner. But I think that's the state of the world today, and I think it's a really strange and interesting one, that the world is becoming sharply more equal and sharply more unequal at the same time.
But there's a hopeful aspect to it.
There is.
And so on that hopeful note, we will end this otherwise depressing program. And our thanks to John Lanchester, New Yorker contributor and author of the new book, How to Speak Money, What the Money People Say and What It Really Means. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We also want to remind everyone here that books will be on sale in the library immediately following the program. We appreciate your letting John make his way to the book signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Michael Lewis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.